As Hannah said, we're starting a new series on the book of Daniel. So over the next couple of months, we're just going to do the six chapters. I'm going to kick that if I don't move out of the way. We're going to cover the first six chapters of the book of Daniel. And today we're doing a chapter at a time. And today we're doing chapter one. But first, before we go into that text, what I wanted to do is give a bit of the historical context of where that fits in, just to try and set the scene. So bear with me. There's going to be some quick fire facts. The book of Daniel sits within a difficult period in the history of the Jewish people. So they'd passed their kind of glory times when King David had helped establish the biggest and broadest span of the land of Israel. Those were the glory years. His son Solomon succeeded him, and he built a great temple in honor of God in Jerusalem. People from surrounding nations were drawn to Jerusalem because of all the beautiful things there, the celebrations that were happening, and the wisdom of King Solomon that God had given him. If these were meant to represent the success of their God, of Yahweh, then he seemed to be doing pretty well during that time. But King David and King Solomon slipped up in their own ways, but the kings that followed them were even worse. They forgot the law that Yahweh had given, and they were distracted by other nations and by their gods. The agreement they had with God, the people had with God, for the blessing of the land was directly linked to their loyalty to him. There was an agreement that is how God had blessed them with that land. And God's faithfulness in bringing about the negative repercussions for their disobedience was just as consistent as his faithfulness in giving them the land in the first place. That's hard to accept sometimes, that God's faithfulness is good in both the positive and the negative. So the nation of Israel was originally built upon the 12 tribes descending from Jacob. But they broke away with a different king leading 10 of those tribes, and that left the two original tribes as the land of Judah, and they kept the capital city of Jerusalem. This is, as a kind of side point there, I think it's really important to try and get ahead around this. And I have to read this kind of stuff again and again before it starts to sit in. But when you hear about what's Judah, what's Israel and that kind of thing, it's really helpful just to go to some of the facts and get that. So Israel was 12 tribes, 10 tribes broke away, and then the two remaining were the land of Judah and the capital city of Jerusalem. The 10 tribes that separated, and they established Samaria as their capital, and they had shrines to other gods because they wanted to try and prevent people from going back to worship in Jerusalem. Eventually, that land was taken over by the Assyrians, and many of the people from that land were taken into exile. The people that were left behind intermarried with different cultures. They lost their identity. They lost their connection with the law of God. And that's why when we get to the New Testament, when you hear about Samaritans being looked down upon, it was because their beliefs had become watered down in this process. Samaritans from Samaria, that capital city of the tribes that had broken off. Back to the land of Judah. I've not got much longer on the history lesson. The land of Judah, they continued to rule. The kings there continued to rule from Jerusalem, but they didn't fare much better. And eventually, a few hundred years later, they also got defeated by the powerful Babylonian Empire. And that's where we're picking up the story of Daniel. So as I said, we're covering Daniel 1. If you want to open your Bibles or your Bible apps and just keep chapter 1 open, we're going to be dipping in and out throughout. It will come up, the verses that I'm talking about will come up on the screen as well. So if we start at Daniel 1:1, seems like a good place to start when we're talking about the book of Daniel. And really, it's just the plain, indisputable facts about what happened. So that verse says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Those were the facts. But then by verse 2, the writer can't help but indicate God's involvement in this event. Verse 2 says, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Those who looked on might have thought that the fall and defeat of this capital city of what was already a dwindling people of God was the same as God himself being defeated. We might make similar comparisons today when we see what we think is the more godly or moral countries lose in some of their battles with evil. Or when we think that maybe the Christian-like politician or political perspective loses, we're confused at why it seems like God himself has lost control. But when the people of Judah might have thought that their God had abandoned them, he was still at work in what probably seemed like a very confusing way. God allowed a temple that was built in his honour to be ransacked and for precious articles within it to be placed in temples to other gods. What was going on? Back to the story in chapter 1, we see that the Babylonian approach to fully conquering a people group was not just about a geographical or a physical victory, it also needed to be a cultural victory. Their approach was to find the brightest, the most up-and-coming, influential people and to use them to spread the Babylonian way. There are also perhaps obvious choices to be removed from the people that were left behind in Jerusalem to kind of remove any hope of an uprising there. If you kind of take away their best people, then they're less likely to try and rise up against their captors. So these special ones were selected, and I was thinking it's a bit like the X Factor. Only a few of them made it through to the live show at the end, and that was the service of the king in this situation. They had to have talent, but they also had to look good and be able to perform under pressure and scrutiny. I've taken some of the material for this talk from a guy called Rich Nathan, who's the pastor of Vineyard Columbus Church in America, Vineyard Church in America. And they did a series on Daniel that we're kind of loosely using as a framework. So you might hear the other guys who are following in the subsequent talks also make reference to the speakers from Vineyard Columbus. Rich Nathan, the pastor there, he took the first one, and he describes this process that the Babylonians use to convert these special chosen ones with a series of words starting with I. It's always nice when you get all starting with the same letter, which is why I'm giving him full credit. I did not come up with these I words. The first one, as we've already said, is identify. So identify who the elite are, who the best, the cream of the crop are. Identify. Secondly, isolate. So those people were separated from their families, from their communities, from the familiarity of what they'd grown up with. Isolate. Next, indoctrinate. So they were taught in a variety of different things, and some of that would have no doubt include challenging all their existing beliefs. Indulge. They were given a taste of the good life, the best food. They lived in comfort. And I wonder if giving them a sample of this would hopefully get them hooked on all those things so that you could use that as a threat to control them, that they were becoming hooked on that way of living. And if it was threatened that would get taken away, they would come into line. And the final I is identity confusion. So for these guys, their names were changed. So if we go back to the text and picking it up at verse 6, verse 6 and 7 says, among these were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. I'm now glad to have the most difficult part of my talk already done. You may say, well, what's the big name about the name change? But for those Jews at the time, they gave their children names that incorporated a shortened form of the Hebrew word for God, which was El, or a shortened form of the Hebrew word for the Lord, which was Ayah or Hya. So that's where we get Yahweh from. So I think we'll come up on the screen. So it's Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. So the names that they had been given were meant to remind them of who they belonged to and where they had come from. But the Babylonians wanted them to forget all of that and to feel like they fitted into their culture instead. I've heard a few stories here of students who in their first year or two have got nicknames. My name, Paul, has always been fairly difficult to nickname. You can't shorten it. But I finally got one in my second year of university. I studied in Nottingham. I started getting called Paolo. You stick a letter on the end because you can't take one away. So I got called that. It stuck for quite a few years. There are still people who know me from my time in Nottingham that call me Paolo. Then when I moved to Leicester, I ended up getting a new name after a little while there. They started calling me El Gatto. My surname is Gatting, that's where it comes from. For those of you who speak Spanish or Portuguese will know that translates to the cat, which is kind of cool, but I spell it with two T's because it just fits better with my surname. And that got extended to some friends there. They even started calling me Black Forest Gatto, which is going the other end. And that went to such an extreme that I then went to a fancy dress party dressed as a Black Forest Gatto just to kind of fully fit in with that name. And it's safe to say, if you shout any of those things at me, I will respond without even thinking about it, because I am familiar with those names. So for those of you just starting university, it might be fun to think about the opportunity to forge a new persona, but be careful not to forget who you are and where you've come from. The same is also true when you start a new job or you move home. You may feel isolated as you're apart from family, friends, and the familiarity of your church community. You might feel indoctrinated by having your faith challenged by intellectual debate with knowledgeable and eloquent people. You might be tempted to indulge because of new opportunities and freedoms. And you could have your identity challenged by allowing people around you to decide what you should be like rather than holding on to the identity you have in Christ. How are you going to respond when faced with these challenges? Back to the text to see what we can learn to help us with that. So we'll pick it up in verse 8. It says, "But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way." So it says that Daniel didn't want to partake in the royal food and wine. And that might seem like a rather trivial thing for Daniel to challenge, especially after they'd already gone through changing his name. But for him, it was quite a serious matter. It's not clear from the text exactly how this seemed offensive to him. It might have been that the food was unclean according to the law that God had set out in Leviticus, and they were dedicated to following the instructions of the Lord. It may have been that this food and drink was taken from sacrifices offered to the Babylonian gods, and that's why they saw it as unclean. It could have been the indulgence and opulence that it signified. Or it might have been a combination of all those things. But Daniel decided to take a stand for purity against what was potentially significant resistance. However, he was actually very respectful in the way he approached this, not wanting to get his overseer in trouble. And they were concerned that they might have looked unhealthy and his overseer would get in trouble for not looking after them properly. So he proposes a test where the four of them, Daniel and his three friends, are given a much simpler diet for 10 days to see whether they end up appearing any less healthy. I don't know what your diet is like, but this sounds pretty depressing and basic to me. They were given nothing but vegetables and water. And before you go on, I reckon it's probably not a tasty selection of colourful vegetables, such as you'd see in a premium salad in a modern delicatessen. I imagine something more plain and bland. And then, only drinking water. That doesn't sound like fun. I'm not sure Alex and Karen would cope. I think I'm allowed to have a jab at them because they're in France, so this is my fun bit. I could be wrong, but I think it's entirely possible that the taps in their house might flow with wine rather than water, so I'm not sure they would cope that well with that. Listen to that on the recording, Alex. I know he will as well. I know different people have different approaches to fasting. And whenever I've fasted for a day, I continue to drink water because I think it's important to stay hydrated. But it's amazing when I do that how fed up I get of the taste of water. And actually, I'm drinking cool, fresh water, whereas Daniel and these guys would probably be drinking something warmer and less pure. And that's all they were drinking. So I would go so far as to say that I think during the 10 days that these four guys were being tested on this diet, God performed a biological miracle. The text says that they looked healthier and better nourished than the others who had been dining on the finest of foods. One translation in a commentary I read phrased it like this: they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh. This simply shouldn't have been the case from what they were eating. But God was looking after them in a special and supernatural way. And he continued to do so. Verse 17 continues saying that the Lord blessed them with an impressive ability to absorb all the knowledge and information that surrounded them. And then to Daniel, God gave a special ability to be able to interpret visions and dreams that we're going to hear about as we go into the other chapters. So the men were put through it in Babylonian boot camp, but came out excelling. And yet, as the story of their diet tells, they were not willing to compromise on the purity and holiness that they believed in. And that was, they felt, was a part of being a follower of God. At the end of their 3 years of training, they made it through and they entered the king's service. And then even when they were there, these four stood out among the crowds. In their conversations with the king, he found them to be more wise, knowledgeable, and helpful than anyone else in their staff, in his staff. The final verse of Daniel 1 says that he remained there until the first year of Cyrus. Now, other historical sources help us to calculate that means that Daniel was there for 70 years in total. And as ever, when we read a lot of these stories in the Bible, do not underestimate the years of patience and consistent commitment that happens between the big events. He was doing this for 70 years. In the next few weeks, as we go through more of what happened to these guys during their time in Babylon, we'll continue to see the challenge that these four men demonstrate for us of how to remain faithful to God and yet still be successful in the world we live in. They weren't the only ones that show us that balance is possible. Similarly, when Jesus was a young man, Luke 2 tells us that he grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. So as we finish up, let's just summarize what we can take away from our look at this first chapter of the book of Daniel. God is always at work. Even when life is tough, even when you feel defeated, and you think that means God's will's been defeated, look carefully to see what God might be trying to work out in this situation. God is always at work. Christians should feel out of place. Know that this world at the moment is not your home. It has a different set of values and priority to yours if you are a follower of Jesus. Don't be surprised if you feel like you're going against the flow of what the world around you thinks you should be like. Pursue holiness and purity. What are the specific challenges that God might be prodding you about to stay true to his instructions and guidance? Dealing with suffering. How are you going to cope with the consequence of staying faithful to God when the world around us tries to drag us in a different direction? How are we going to present ourselves while we're eating vegetables and drinking water, while those around us are indulging in luxurious food and drinking fancy wine? But despite this, despite the fact we are different from the world around us and we are meant to be, we still pray for that world. God spoke through the prophet Jeremiah to those in exile in Babylon, the same group of people, that despite being controlled by these conquerors with vastly different beliefs, that they should pray for their blessing. Jeremiah 29:7, this is the Lord speaking to those people through the prophet Jeremiah. It says, "Seek the peace and prosperity of the city of Babylon, to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper." What does that mean for us? Maybe we're meant to pray for our blessings on our workplace, on our company, that they might exceed, for our schools, for our universities, that they might excel in their fields. Maybe it means even praying for your country, which I'll admit that personally and more recently I find it hard when I hear some stories of what I think are sometimes our country making cruel and selfish decisions for its own benefit rather than looking to bless others. But I should want my company, my city, my country to exceed, because the Lord tells us to pray for it and pray that it would prosper. Because if it prospers, you too will prosper. And finally, you can stay faithful to God and still succeed in this world. Often the world will recognize our usefulness when we stay diligent to our commitment to what God has called us to. Whether that's our job or our studies, we should aim to do it well, just as these guys in Babylon did. We should work hard, whatever our context, but just remember to step up to the challenge to stay loyal to God. That's what I think we can learn from Daniel 1. As we said, we're going to continue through the story. You're going to hear some more of these themes as we go through the remainder of the talks.